Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to our House Committee on Transportation and Economic Development this fine day, February 17th, 2016. Welcome to our committee. I would like to acknowledge briefly that there are some guests in the audience today. We have John Souter and Elise Hamner from Coos Bay, and we also have Elise's son, who was a page this morning. We're delighted he's here, Teal Hamner. So welcome. They're here today to learn a little bit about what this legislature does on a daily basis. And Teal worked on the House floor this morning, so he served us very well this morning. Welcome.
Thank you.
Mr. Brennan, tell us a little bit about Senate Bill 1589, and then we will open a public hearing.
Sure, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 1589 comes to us from the Senate, where it passed the Senate floor 21-8. There's minimal fiscal and minimal revenue impact and no amendments before us. The measure modifies the definition of qualified business eligible for loans or credit guarantees from the Credit Enhancement Fund to include existing or proposed businesses that are located in Oregon and that will produce substantial benefits for the state. It declares emergency would take effect upon passage and signature by the governor.
Thank you very much. And on that note, I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1589. And I believe Senator Montes Anderson is here to speak to this bill.
And Representative Senator Rosenbaum is there.
Oh, wonderful. Please join us. Welcome to our committee, Senator.
I'm going to let Nolan proceed first.
Please tee this up for us.
Well, thank you, and hope that will serve as a good example of what we do here. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Nolan Plesha. I'm a legislative assistant to Senator Diane Rosenbaum, state senator representing District 21, which includes Inner Southeast Portland, Milwaukee, and Oak Grove. I am here today to testify on her behalf. So thank you for the opportunity to be here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 1589. Senate Bill 1589 is a simple, straightforward bill that will inject more capital into Oregon's small businesses. The Credit Enhancement Fund was created 25 years ago to help small businesses gain access to the capital they need in order to operate and grow. The program is administered by the Oregon Business Development Department and offers loan insurance to regulated lenders, often our community banks and credit unions, to help businesses obtain financing to expand and create jobs. The average insured business has fewer than 15 employees, and many are in our rural communities. Senate Bill 1589 permanently reinstates the amendments to the Credit Enhancement Fund that was made by House Bill 4150 in 2012. And expands the eligibility criteria for small businesses. This will allow any new or existing Oregon businesses to be eligible as long as their operations produce substantial benefits to the state. Prior to 2012, loans were limited to traded sector, manufacturing, production, processing, and distribution companies, and to businesses located in distressed communities or if developing a brownfield. As the economy rustled to come back from the global recession and more communities came off the distress list, many quality businesses found themselves ineligible for these loans. The Oregon legislature responded by expanding the definition of qualified businesses for the Credit Enhancement Fund to include non-traded sector businesses, such as retail and service businesses, and clarified the definition of distressed communities with a sunset date of July 1st, 2015. Fortunately, the overall economy has continued to improve since the recession, allowing more communities to be taken off the distressed rolls. However, with the sunset of our amendments to the program from 2012, and as more communities continue to lose their designation, many small businesses that formerly would have been eligible no longer qualify for the Credit Enhancement Fund program. Currently, Benton, Clackamas, Deschutes, Hood River, Morrow, Multnomah, Sherman, Tillamook, Wasco, Washington, and Yamhill counties are no longer designated as distressed. Nine more counties, including Clatsop, Columbia, Jackson, Lane, Lincoln, Marion, Polk, Union, and Wheeler, are also likely to lose their distressed designation in the near future. According to Business Oregon, there are about 13 projects that have been unable to receive loans due to losing their eligibility this summer. Since the beginning of this program, the Credit Enhancement Fund has helped ensure over 548 loans to small businesses throughout Oregon, creating thousands of jobs. Right now, the program has the ability to ensure an additional $30 million in loans. And if we do not act now to make these changes permanent and simplify the eligibility requirements, we won't be able to use all the money and many small businesses will suffer. We have the tools and resources to ensure a stronger future for Oregon small businesses. This is why it is so important that we act now, and I urge you to join us in supporting this bill and to restore this vital program. Thank you for your time and consideration, and I will try to answer any questions that you have.
Thank you very much. I think we'll listen to the senator and then open the panel to questions.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. I'm State Senator Lori Monis Anderson, and I represent Gresham, Troutdale, Wood Village, and Fairview, a little bit of Portland. I'm happy to be here to support Senate Bill 1589, and it truly does simplify the eligibility criteria, and it's going to allow new and existing businesses to be eligible. It's important for us to help our small businesses. They are the backbone of our economy. And with the additional $30 million in business grants and loans, these changes will really create, I believe, many more opportunities for Oregon small businesses who need the capital and they need the support for their operations and growth. There are about 90% of businesses that access these funds. They are located in rural Oregon, and that's why I'm very excited to make sure that it still will go to our rural communities as well as to other areas within the state. This will help our small businesses, and I would hope that you look favorably on this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Questions for this panel? Representative Davis.
Thank you, Chair. And if there's somebody from Business Oregon who's going to be testifying,
yes,
then I can ask specifics of that person.
Okay.
Thank you.
Any other questions for this panel?
Looks great.
Then we will excuse you. Thank you so much
for
being here today.
Thank you for considering
introducing this important topic. John, thank you for being here. We also have one other person that's listed that would like to speak. Mr. Cowan, would you like to step up as well? I think we'll begin with Mr. Sears. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. Chair McEwen, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Sears, Business Services Manager at the Oregon Business Development Department. I work in the section of the agency that actually administers the program. Mm-hmm. Did not prepare any comments necessarily for you at this time, but I am here to answer any questions related to the program.
Representative Davis.
Thank you very much for being here. I appreciate it. Just looking on the website, trying to understand better what the Oregon Credit Enhancement Fund is, the website says the program is available to most any existing or new business through June 30th, 2015. So can you clarify, is this without passage of this bill, does it mean the program's not available after that date?
Madam Chair, members of the community, so a couple of things. First, the program itself, what it does, it provides insurance on loans that banks and credit unions make. So to answer your question, what happened was there was some expansion to the program that actually sunsetted effective June 30, 2015. It makes the eligibility criteria a little bit more complicated in areas that are considered to not be distressed. And this basically this bill makes the fund easier for a lender to use and identify firms that they can enroll into the program.
Well, thanks for clarifying that. So as I look at the actual bill, on lines 13 through 21, that's substantial changes are there. Current law then is that the program is still available, but the business would have to be located in a distressed area, mm-hmm, sell goods or services into a traded sector economy, or be a traded sector business, own real property containing a brownfield. So it would be limited currently to brownfield properties.
Chair, members of the committee. So the criteria themselves. There's a couple of orders there. The first thing is they need to be a business in Oregon.
Yeah.
So this next determination that a lender would need to make is this company located in a distressed area or not?
Mm-hmm.
If it is not located in a distressed area, then the lender. Okay, and this is why we have this bill, right? So if the company is located in a community that is not considered to be distressed, then the companies that are eligible are limited to traded sector companies, which are typically manufacturing, distribution, and processing. In non-distressed communities, basically any retail and service-oriented companies would no longer be eligible at this time.
And could you then comment on the brownfield aspect as well?
Madam Chair, the program would continue to have a ability to insure loans made to a company that are, you know, basically in a brownfield site or facility. It's been a provision that's been in the law since 1991 when it's introduced. I can tell you that we have not used that potential allowance since 1991.
Maybe that'll change.
Yes.
But that's whether it's a distressed community or not.
Correct.
Yes, Representative McLean.
To your point on it being in the books since like 1990-something, is it a state and or federal law as far as the definition of distressed?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, it is the agency actually has a process for determining what is a distressed community or not.
Mm-hmm.
I'll be honest, I'm not the subject matter expert, but we have an economist that actually runs that data and posts it to our website. So it's a state formula.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Benz.
Madam Chair, I recall we've had discussions about this bill over the past 9 years I've been here. And I recall that there were reasons that came into play, the distressed area piece and the international competition piece and the traded sector piece. Those were all important areas that we wanted to emphasize with this program and support with this program. The question, of course, is this broadens that space dramatically. There is no space anymore. It's just anything that's good for Oregon is what I see now. So the question is, was there value to the focus of this bill to Oregon, and were we able to achieve things in that area that would not have occurred? Because the thinking here was, as I recall from all the discussions with Representative Reed, that we were doing our best to make sure whatever we did with this money brought more jobs to this state. That's why the traded sector element was in it. And I just wonder if I don't know what substantial benefits means, to be honest with you, but that was the attempt. So my question, going back, first part of my rambling, was the thing working? Were we creating decent jobs in these sectors?
Chair, members of the committee, the program has done a successful job in creating jobs. And prior to this legislation that was introduced in 2012, the fund was operating with finite resources. We still operate with finite resources. But what changed in 2010, we received an infusion of federal funds into this program that allowed us to greatly expand the program well beyond what the state funds allowed us to do. In essence, the ability to expand the program, we've been able to support more businesses. We have capacity to continue to support businesses. The program itself will continue to target and have preference for traded sector companies. The banks and credit unions that use this type of a program, by the nature of some of the tools in the program, will continue to support traded sector. And an example of this would be that different from the federal guarantee programs out there, the state program has the ability to offer insurance on operating lines of credit. Typically, on retail and service-oriented businesses, you don't have a significant demand for operating capital. When you're traded sector, you need to cover payroll, work in progress, receivables, things of that nature, whereas with cash-based businesses, you don't necessarily have that. So the tools and resources that are available will continue to support traded sector. That won't change. I just think that the infusion of capital from the federal government has really allowed us to broaden the program and make it easier and more accessible to businesses across the state.
Follow up?
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I noticed that a number of senators, most from rural districts, voted against the bill. Was that because of the why? I don't want to guess. Do you have any idea what their – I should have asked the senator when she was here. She might have had a better idea. But perhaps you heard testimony or something about why there was not support.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I honestly can't answer that question as to why they wouldn't or didn't support the bill. I do know that there were comments made in the committee meeting. I probably reference you back to those and maybe connect with those senators.
Follow up.
Yes, Representative.
Thank you. So looking again at the bill, I don't see anything that directs how you would spend the money other than substantial benefits. Is there something else there that's you're going to be looking at?
Members of the committee, Chair, so the department will establish what substantial benefit is an administrative rule. And we've spent a little bit of time thinking about how that should look. Substantial benefit is going to be related to things that we currently do as an agency. Job creation and retention, obviously. Firms that provide goods and services to traded sector companies. Increase in sales, access to new markets, things of that nature. The flip side is activities that don't provide substantial benefit to the state wouldn't be eligible. Now, there are things that don't necessarily provide a direct benefit. If you're doing a straight debt refinance, there's really not much public benefit that comes from something like that. A partial partner buyout or a stock acquisition, financing intangible assets, those are things that typically don't have a public benefit. The benefit usually goes to an individual as opposed to a community. And I would probably follow up to you on the rural component. This program really does support rural communities. If you look at the banks and credit unions that do enroll loans, really 60% of those are outside of MSA regions. And by those, I mean Portland, Salem, Eugene, Bend. So you're removing a pretty significant portion of the population. I've got some numbers and things I can share with you, but about 60% of these loans have gone into communities with less than 25% of the total population of the state. So this is reaching rural communities and providing resources there. Other areas do benefit. You know, we make loans, help banks make loans in Eugene and Bend and Salem and Portland, but it does really reach into the communities very well.
Thank you.
Representative Hack, did you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think you partially just answered it, but I'm just curious on, in removing the distressed community aspect, what is your plan or what happens with providing equity across the state as far as where these are going to go? You just said 60% go to the rural communities. Is that is there some criteria for that? Is it just whatever comes along? I mean, can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the outreach that the department does really helps us drive this program out into rural communities, and really that's not going to change. When we work with the lending community, typically we're meeting with bankers on a regular basis, and we're meeting with bankers that don't necessarily have the resources to utilize guarantee programs that the federal government offers, you know, typically SBA and the USDA B&I guarantee. The reason being is that those programs come with a lot more regulations, and if the bank isn't able to keep up with all the regulations, if they have a loss, sometimes they don't get paid on their claim. The thing that makes this program work effectively for community banks and smaller banks is that this program really lines up with how they administer and monitor their commercial loans and lines of credit to small business. So this really is part of their process, and we keep an open dialogue with them. If we have a credit that may be being downgraded or defaulting, we work with them through the process to ensure that the bank doesn't miss out on their opportunity to submit a claim to the state to cover their loss.
Can I have a follow up?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. So, what I'm getting is it is carte blanche, though. There's nothing that says that there's any equity across the state for representation of these loans. It's pretty much whatever you get.
Madam Chair, that's correct. There's not a required preference for any underserved community or geographic community.
Can I have one more?
No regional distribution is what you're saying. If you qualify.
Yes, yes.
Can I have one more? Representative, thank you, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. When you just mentioned the default issue, could you tell me what's the percentage of these loans that do end up in default, say, in the last couple of years?
Madam Chair, members of the community,
you can go further back.
Since 1991, the default rate on the loan program is 0.8%. So it's less than 1%. Over the last 5 years, the default rate, I believe, is 0.4%. So relatively low default rate. I believe that a lot of this is because of the close interaction that the lender has with these businesses, because they are risk rated, a higher risk. Therefore, the bankers are required to stay in touch with their borrowers on a much more frequent basis.
Thank you.
Mr. Sears, if you compared that with other loan default rates in your other programs, where would that stack up?
Madam Chair, it would be, I'll try not to bore you with too much data or detail.
That's fine.
Our direct loan program, the Oregon Business Development Loan Fund, historically has a default rate under 2% since inception, so slightly higher. It is a revolving loan program and different. Our microloan program, default rate probably about 8-10%, so much higher, but those are high-risk loans, startup companies. So that gives you a little bit of where this is at in that spectrum.
Great. Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Sears? Representative Davis.
Thank you, Chair, and thanks again for your testimony. And maybe I missed this. What's the total amount of loans that are guaranteed?
Approximately $80 million is what we could cover from an insurance perspective. Current portfolio is about $50 million in exposure.
Thank you.
I have one.
Yes, Representative Gorsuch.
I don't mean to belabor this, but I do want to go back to something that Representative Bentz brought up. So that term, substantial benefit, is, as he pointed out, it's somewhat troubling. I understood your response. When will we see something that maybe has a little more definition to it? Because, I mean, it could mean a lot of things.
Chair, members of the committee, I don't know, so I say community all the time.
We represent communities.
Yes,
yeah, that too.
We plan on doing this through the administrative rule, and obviously there is a formal rulemaking process that goes with that. Obviously, we'd be happy to notify all of you when we're going through that. I can share with you kind of a meatier list of things that it may include.
Okay.
If you share it with Mr. Brennan,
sure.
And he can distribute it. And if you would notify us when the rulemaking occurs, there may be some who would like to participate in that.
Yes.
So thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Cowan, thank you for joining us today. Welcome to my committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Tim Cowan. My interest started when I testified this summer on small business procurement. And I had a hard time, but finally, after testifying about three times, tied in the amount of time it took for the state to pay the contractor upon acceptance. And if they took 90 days or whatever, then the bank would discount that receivable, and the company would be out there and trying to survive. I put my qualifications down, and I'd go over those just real quick, because you can ask me questions about anything about financing, and I'll answer them for you. I wrote and taught a program on financial analysis and loan structure that every lender and branch manager had to go through for First National Bank. I worked in special credits, which were large commercial workouts. I was responsible in national accounts for all business relationships west of the Mississippi that were headquartered outside the state but had operations in the state. I was a regional manager, senior vice president for Mid-Valley, Central, and Eastern Oregon. It was about $1 billion in assets, so I'm pretty familiar with the different communities across the state. One last thing, real quick, and I'll get to the bill. I wrote this down, that I spoke at the Oregon Bankers Association annual meeting on problem loan prevention, and I also spoke at the Oregon Bar Association on how to prevent problem accounts. What I did is I looked at the bill, and I did not give you or John the courtesy of researching everything that it referred to. I apologize for that. My interest is on the loan and credit guarantees. Who controls the credit quality? Does the bank or does the state? Who can adjust the terms? Who can take collection actions? I'm going to say that probably the bank is going to maintain control. They're the ones that are going to review the credit quality, and they'll be the ones that make the adjustments on the loan. Another one that I thought was interesting is when they collect on a bad account, who gets paid back, and what are the methods of doing that? When I used to put loan participations together, we would decide right up front, first in, first out. So if I put the money first in, then I'm the first one to collect on an asset when a liquidation. But if they had money in it already and then I put more in, I'm last in, first out. I'll go ahead and help them, but I want to be first out. So if the state came in and said, here's a company that's in trouble or needs a little help and it's got a banking relationship, then I would go in and say, look, I'll give you the money, but I'm the last in, but I want to be the first one out, because you've already identified the fact that there's an issue with your account. If the loan is not performing, who makes the decision on what terms are going to be? Because there are times, like in special credits, I would get into an account, and in order to save it, I might either try to collect it, give more money, but I'm going to adjust the terms on the loan. So I don't know who has the authority or the ability to adjust it, and or whether they need permission from both sides.
I'm sorry. Please continue. I was asking Mr. Sears if he wanted to join us, if he had answers to some of these questions. So please continue.
Thank you. The one thing was on financial impact. I read an article in Oregonian and wrote an article, gave it to the Secretary of State, but one of the issues was money that was given to a company that was doing manufacturing solar panels. And one of the comments was they were given tax credits. I don't know how you recognize that in a budget or anything else, but they sold those tax credits and used it for working capital. That was what was in the article. Now, Section 1. Working capital. Does a company need working capital? When I wrote my program and trained it, had to identify what's working capital. Does a company need it? If they need it, how much do they need? And if they don't have enough, how do they go get some? Because part of my job was, if a company needed working capital, I would go in and try to give that to them, fix it without having them have to borrow any money, period. And I did have companies that didn't require working capital. So here's what I would suggest to you, or give you some thoughts. Monitor float, because there could be contingent liabilities, and how money or commitments made. You could have a heck of a lot of commitments out there. And then what does that do to budgets? When I was in national accounts, I had $630 million worth of loan commitments. But that had nothing to do with how much was outstanding. So they might look at my accounts and say, look, there's risk of $100 million. No, I've got commitments out there that tomorrow someone could come and take it. So that needed to be reported. So you might want to look at that and consider that in your equation. I'll have to say one thing. What John said, if he's getting 0.8, 0.4 loan loss reserve, that's good. Because when I had the region with about $1 billion, I was doing about a quarter to a third. So that he's doing, that program's going well. I don't see that needing to be adjusted at all. So I'll leave you with this. Monitor float and look at what type of reserves are available, and that reserve can also be what's the company's financial reserve? Can they take much risk? And also the bank. What can they take or not take? I'm sorry.
Do you have a response?
Madam Chair, any of these points? There was a number of points that Mr. Cowan raised, and just to maybe hit on one or two, as far as how the process works when there's a default, we work very closely with the bankers, and to Mr. Cowan's point, the lenders typically want to modify the terms of the loan. They don't want to collect. They don't want to foreclose. They don't want to shut down a business any more than we do. And so what they're going to continue to do is work with the borrower. If the modification is something that's outside of what the insurance allows, so when we insure a loan, we say your term is going to be X, your rate will be Y, and we've got additional loan covenants that you'll have to monitor and put into place in order for the insurance to be available. If they go outside of that, they need to come to us for permission. We take a look at the recommendation that the lender is making. We will underwrite it ourselves and make a determination as to whether or not that's a prudent financial decision.
But that's a close relationship between the state and the lender at that point in time.
Correct. Okay. Correct. Very close working relationship. So basically that's one of the reasons that the loss rate is low, and we continue to work with them in order to ensure that the business has every opportunity to be successful and the bank can mitigate its loss. So that's probably a high-level answer.
Any follow-up questions?
Some of that.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen. We appreciate your testimony today. I'm sure we will be I'm going to turn to Mr. Brennan and talk a little bit about Monday. I think I'm going to go ahead and – is there anyone else who wants to comment on this bill, House Bill 1589? Then I'm going to close the hearing on Senate Bill 1589 and turn to Mr. Brennan to talk to us about what we have on schedule for Monday. And I think we're scheduled to work this bill, if I'm correct.
Yes, Madam Chair. This bill is currently the only bill in our committee, but we are expecting bills to come off the Senate floor. They should have come off today, but of course, because of the circumstances, the floor session is the third readings did not occur today. So we're expecting, I believe, two additional bills. Senate Bill 1543 is the Wine Country Vehicle Registration Plate bill, and 1583 deals with the Credit Enhancement Fund. That was there's another bill.
Stump the administrator.
Out there.
It is
all the numbers.
Stump the administrator.
Which one is it? Thank you,
Office of Small Business Assistance.
Thank you, Wendy. Appreciate that. I knew there was in there somewhere. All the numbers are merging together.
So we expect to get
those two bills, assuming, of course, that they make it off the Senate floor tomorrow, which I believe the Senate is planning to stay late enough to make sure they clear all of their Senate bills so that they can come over to be assigned to the policy committee, because tomorrow is the deadline. Any bill not assigned and scheduled in a policy committee for a work session tomorrow can't get a work session, which means my understanding of how it's going to work is that those bills will all have to come off the Senate floor, and they'll all have, and then the House will have to convene and first read them so they can be assigned, so that they can be scheduled. And that may happen after 5 o'clock. It probably will happen after 5 o'clock.
We have until midnight, though.
Yes, we have until midnight, and it'll almost certainly be possible to do it by then.
Oh, thank you.
Won't be possible to do it before the evening time. So they're expecting an evening four session.
So the 5 o'clock
means for both House and Senate.
Five o'clock deadline does not apply. We will have potentially a floor session tomorrow night, so we will be in session, and the deadline will be extended, so there'll be a little breathing room to get those bills over.
Right, so then functionally for our Monday meeting, then we'll have the work session on this bill, and then public hearing and possible work session on the other bills.
And that may complete our business for this short session in this committee at that time. All right. Any questions, anything for the good of the order? All right, thank you all. On that note, we are adjourned. Thank you all.
I had a certain lapse of reason where I was like, which one is it?